From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Big money, political influence, and the right to free speech. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. In 1907, trust-busting President Teddy Roosevelt persuaded Congress to ban corporations from contributing to political campaigns. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court considered reversing more than 100 years of finance limitations that now cover unions as well as corporations. The ACLU and the National Rifle Association advocate letting them spend in the interest of unlimited free speech. Democrat Russ Feingold and Republican John McCain warn that a flood of money will drown out the voices of ordinary citizens. We'll get that story today. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Hello again, Marvin Alney back with To the Point. That attack video called Hillary the Movie is at the heart of a case that could change the way political campaigns for federal offices have been financed for more than 100 years. We'll hear about today's extraordinary session of the U.S. Supreme Court, the first for the new Justice, Sonia Sotomayor. On Reporter's Notebook, can the U.S. afford human exploration in space? What about private enterprise? First, this news update. There is evidence today that Afghanistan is getting more dangerous for reporters. A British commando raid has rescued Stephen Farrell of the New York Times, who was seized on Saturday. But one of the commandos was killed, along with an Afghan woman and Farrell's interpreter, Sultan Munadi. Bob Dietz is Asia Program Coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists. And Bob Dietz, many thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Do we know who captured these journalists?
No, apparently a Taliban group, but we're not sure who they were or what their intentions were. The Times is busy sort of researching that themselves, and frankly, we don't have that much information on who took them.
Is it unusual that a commando group would try to rescue reporters, as was done in this case?
I think so. We haven't particularly heard this in Afghanistan before, and there's always a great deal of risk in undertaking operations like that. So yes, at least for Afghanistan, I'm not aware of any other cases.
Obviously, this was a very dangerous operation because a commando was lost and others were killed as well. What do we know about their deaths?
Not that much, and the information is slowly emerging, but. It sounded like a high-risk operation in which people's lives were lost. I mean, our greatest concern is the loss of the Afghan journalist Sultan Munadi, who was a pretty good reporter for the New York Times and had a reputation as being a very sensible guy.
You were in Afghanistan as recently in July. I take it you knew Sultan Munadi and other Afghan journalists. Are they particularly at risk?
Well, Afghanistan's always been a dangerous place for reporters, and unlike many other countries, a lot of foreign reporters have died there, usually out of proportion to the local numbers. Around the world, about 85% of the journalists killed are local journalists covering local stories, and that would apply to Munadi. I think what we're seeing in Afghanistan is an increasingly dangerous battlefield, people are at greater risk as they try and cover that story. Local reporters face not only that sort of risk, getting caught in crossfire, but also the risk of being targeted by local figures, power figures, drug lords, gun runners, corrupt government officials, those sort of things. So yeah, it is a high risk story to cover, and it looks increasingly like the risk is just getting worse and worse.
What particularly was the story that they were attempting to cover?
Well, they were covering a story in Kunduz about a story of great international significance in which there had been an airstrike on some oil tankers that had apparently been hijacked by the Taliban, and we're not sure about the details. But the Afghan government and people in the area claimed that there were a large number of civilians who were taking fuel from the tankers who were killed in the attack. And the NATO said they were going to investigate. First, there was a denial. But then I think it became apparent that this was going to become a real issue. And they were trying to get to the bottom of the story and getting pretty close.
How important are interpreters who are also journalists such as Sultan Munadi?
Well, they're critical to the news gathering operation at this point, especially in countries like Afghanistan and Iraq, too. Increasingly, we see newspapers, you know, giving them bylines and crediting them with the reporting and acknowledging their role. But for a long time, the reality has been that it's local reporters with that local knowledge, that local entree, that ability to operate within the society that have been a mainstay in doing that reporting. And I think if you ask any foreign correspondents from major newspapers or media organizations, that they will not hesitate to tell you that these people are critical in this news-gathering operation.
I'm going to interrupt you for a second because we're short of time. Is embedding a way to get around the dangers that we're hearing about now?
I think it's a bad solution, and I think everyone knows it. But increasingly, we're seeing that as the solution.
Bad solution because?
Because you're not getting both sides of the story, because you basically said, I'm going to look at this situation from one point of view and that alone. And that that's bad whether you're embedded with NATO, with the U.S. Army, or with the Taliban. You don't get the full story, and I think everyone recognizes that as an increasing evil.
All right, to some serious difficulties in covering an increasingly difficult war. Bob Dietz, Asian coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists, many thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much, Warren.
In a moment, big money, political influence, and the right to free speech on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. 3 weeks before its next session is officially scheduled to open, with Justice Sonia Sotomayor on the bench for the first time, the U.S. Supreme Court today heard a case that could change 100 years of campaign finance laws. Last year, the Federal Elections Commission banned the broadcast of a video called Hillary the Movie because it was funded by a corporation. Today's unusual hearing was called for arguments on whether the ban on corporate contributions violates the constitutional right to free speech. Joan Biskupic is author of an upcoming book on Justice Antonin Scalia. She reports on the court for USA Today. And Joan Biskupic, good to have you back on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
I gather this went pretty fast. The justices seemed to know what they wanted to ask.
That's right. It was the fastest 90 minutes I've ever been there for. We got our first view of Sonia Sotomayor as a justice and also of Elena Kagan as the new Solicitor General. But there was a lot of predictability about this session. It looks like they're breaking down 5-4 the way we might have predicted, with the more conservative justices, led by John Roberts, wanting to change the rules for corporate money in politics, and the more liberal justices putting up a fight.
John Roberts, of course, the Supreme Court, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. What did he say that indicated to you that he wants to change the law?
Well, I'll tell you, the key thing is that he was very skeptical about the soundness of a 1990 case that's known as Austin versus Michigan Chamber of Commerce. And it was in that case that the justices, for the first time, clearly allowed a state or any kind of government to regulate corporate spending in elections, with a specific ban that said you had the corporations in this state, it happened to be Michigan, couldn't spend general treasury money on candidates. They had to set up PACs or a special committee to funnel money into an election. And the Chief Justice, John Roberts, seemed very skeptical of whether that 1990 precedent should endure. That case was also reinforced by a 2003 ruling that upheld limits on corporate expenditures. And he was quite scrutinizing of Solicitor General Kagan's position, and he and the other new justice who sits on the right, Samuel Alito, both seemed like they were definitely leaning toward voting in a way that would change the rules, get rid of those two decisions. Now, Warren, as you know, we've had a couple reversals by this court where we hear oral arguments and we think they're heading in one direction, and then they surprise us in the end. But this one, I think, is they gave us clearer signs. And frankly, the clearest sign they gave us is when they ordered this case re-argued last June and said they wanted to look at the much broader question, more consequential question of whether to strike down these past decisions that generally permit regulation of corporate spending in political elections.
So they're going well beyond the debate over Hillary, the movie, and whether or not that was an appropriate kind of expression by a nonprofit corporation in that case. But you mentioned cases in 1990 and 2003, but doesn't the ban on corporate limitations go back to 1907 with Teddy Roosevelt?
Well, that's right, and that's the point that new Solicitor General Elena Kagan made right from the get-go. She started her arguments by saying, you're looking at 100 years of practice by Congress trying to curb what corporations do. And she really tried to make the case that corporations are very different from individuals. Corporations have different financial interests, different broader social interests. And it was the Chief Justice John Roberts who stopped her a couple times on those. And then also fellow conservative Antonin Scalia said, you know, all corporations aren't the same. We're talking about nonprofits and profits, big companies, as he said at one point, railroad barons, but then also someone down the street who runs a hair salon or who runs a little car dealership. And that's one issue with this law, is that it prohibits the airing of election ads by corporations, and it doesn't say the corporations can only be for profit. It sweeps in all corporations, and frankly, it also sweeps in all labor unions. So the AFL-CIO and other unions are carefully watching this case, too.
Did they provide a friend of the court briefs of any kind?
Yes, the AFL-CIO is in this case on the side of Citizens United, which produced this scathingly critical film called Hillary the Movie, which, as some of your listeners probably remember, is a montage of news footage and harsh commentary by critics such as Newt Gingrich and Ann Coulter. And just to give you a sense of how the stakes have been ratcheted up, when you asked about friend of the court briefs, Warren, before the first oral arguments last March, I think there were about 13 friend of the court briefs submitted, you know, for the parties on this in this case. And then when the justices said they were going to order these re-arguments on the broader consequential question, 41 filings came in from scores of groups, because a lot is at stake in terms of corporate money and politics.
Joan Biskupic, again, legal affairs correspondent for USA Today. Here's what you mentioned that 2003 decision that had to do with the so-called McCain-Feingold Act, which was passed in 2002. That's one of the major campaign finance laws that's been passed since 1907. Today, both Feingold and McCain had something to say about it. Senator McCain said he thought that the justices were somewhat naive about the influence of money from both corporations and unions on the legislative process. Here's a bit of what he had to say.
Does anyone believe that the rights of average citizens to be heard in Washington would not be overridden by massive campaign, unlimited campaign contributions from corporations and unions? That is a disconnect from reality. We saw the corruption. That's why we acted.
John McCain outside the U.S. Supreme Court today. You can hear the traffic in the background. Bradley Smith is a former chair of the Federal Election Commission. He's chairman of the Center for Competitive Politics and professor of law at Capital University in Ohio. Professor, thank you for joining us today.
Hey, my pleasure, Warren.
You're on which side of this?
I am supporting Citizens United. I both was represented as one of eight former FEC commissioners who filed an amicus brief supporting Citizens United, and an organization of which I am chairman, the Center for Competitive Politics, filed an amicus brief on behalf of Citizens United.
Okay. Citizens United was the nonprofit that produced Hillary the Movie, which the then Federal Elections Commission said was a violation of federal law. What's wrong with this federal law?
Well, I mean, the federal law is basically wrong because it limits the speech of corporations. And corporations are associations of people who have speech interest. You know, it's kind of mind-boggling if you think about it that a week before an election or a month before an election, a candidate can go out and he can declare that he wants to regulate some business or maybe even close those businesses down, make it illegal. And it's illegal for those businesses to respond to that. And the government, in its argument in March, I think one of the reasons this case was scheduled for re-argument, pushed, in fact, the position that they've taken for a long time, which is, you know, think about this ban again. As you and Joan noted in your discussion, this bans all corporations, regardless of the type. The government's position was, therefore, that it could ban a book if it were published by a corporation, which, of course, most books are. It could ban a movie distributed by a corporation, which, of course, most movies are. It could ban newsletters, internet, anything but a corporation put out about politics. And I think that's just wholly incompatible with the First Amendment. I think the court recognized that, and they said, you know, where do you get that from? The government said, we get it from Austin and McConnell, these two cases. And the court said, well, maybe we'd better rethink those cases.
What do you think is likely to happen? Do you think that there might be some sort of distinction made in the law or in the decision between different kinds of corporations, or do you think there might be the wholesale throwing out of the ban on corporate involvement?
Well, certainly it might be possible for the court to come up with a narrow resolution of the issue, probably more likely by holding that all nonprofits in some way are exempt or that somehow the statute didn't cover the speech that Citizens United was engaged in. But all of those would be tough. I mean, really the way the question has been presented to them, was forced on them in the original case, sets it up for sort of an all or nothing type of occurrence. Now, listening to parts of the argument today, the clear sense I had, as Ted Olson, representing Citizens United, put forward their argument and giving some of the questions, is that it might be conceivable that if the court were to strike down a blanket corporate ban at this point in time, states or Congress could come back with more targeted bans that specifically aimed to address particular fears, such as foreign-owned corporations or very large corporations. But again, right now, what they're presented with in this case is a complete ban that bans every little tiny, you know, two-person outfit. It bans the local car dealer. It bans every nonprofit. And that's a pretty sweeping statute to comport with the First Amendment.
Bradley Smith, again, the former chair of the Federal Election Commission. Rick Hassan is a professor of law at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. He writes electionlawblog.org. And, Professor, good to have you on our program.
Good to be with you.
You, I take it, are in favor of upholding the current law. What do you say to the arguments we just heard from Bradley Smith?
Well, I actually didn't hear all of what Brad Smith had to say, but I can anticipate some of those arguments having just finished listening to the rebroadcast. I don't know that this is a case where Citizens United should necessarily lose, even as a supporter of reasonable regulations of spending on corporations. There are many reasons to treat this case differently. I think the real question is whether or not the court should issue a broad ruling here, which would be unnecessary, that would say that not just this small ideological group like Citizens United, but the largest corporations in America and the largest unions can spend whatever money they want from their general treasury funds on candidate election-related activities.
Well, now, we just heard Bradley Smith, perhaps this was before you came aboard, say that what the current law does is limit the speech of corporations. We heard earlier that Chief Justice Roberts said that corporations and individuals are – or corporations are individuals and have the same kind of free speech rights. Do you disagree with that?
Well, you know, there's a question as to whether or not corporations should be treated the same way. Justice Sotomayor, in one of her first questions, said maybe the path we went down that was wrong was to say that we should treat corporations in exactly the same way. But even in a case called Bilotti, where the court said that corporations can spend what they want in ballot measure elections, the court said the question is not whether corporations have First Amendment rights, but the rights of voters to hear what corporations have to say. So I don't know that in this context the court has squarely said that we're going to treat these two the same. And I think there are reasons not to. And I think that, you know, we live in a country where we have a free market system and we have vast disparities in wealth, and that's, you know, a necessary part of our free market system. But I think that the public has a right to say that we shouldn't, that we could put limits so that we don't translate those economic inequalities into political equality. inequality, so that we can have a more level playing field. That's the argument, I think, that the court endorsed in that 1990 Austin case, in which the government walked away from today at oral argument.
Again, Rick Hassan is professor at Loyola Law School. Here's what Russ Feingold, the Democrat from Wisconsin, who gave his name along with Senator McCain to the McCain-Feingold Act, had to say about this issue of big corporations.
The idea that in an era of AIG and Exxon, that their corporate treasuries would be opened up to destroy the political process, this is a very bizarre time for these justices to be considered to destroy this longstanding law that has protected our democracy.
Again, Senator Feingold, outside the U.S. Supreme Court building today. Bradley Smith, back to you. How do you counter that argument that corporations such as AIG or Exxon, which at the moment have bad reputations in general, wouldn't simply swamp everybody else with all of the money that they have to bring to bear on an election?
Well, I think there's a couple reasons to think that that's not true. And first, I would point out, I do think if the court overturns its ban, you'll get more corporate speech. I mean, that's part of the object, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. But empirically, that's not been the case. For example, right now, a majority of the states allow corporations to engage in exactly the type of spending that is issued in this case. And by the way, it's not contributions directly to candidates' campaigns. It's just spending by the corporation independently of those campaigns that's at issue. But a majority of the states allow that, and they don't have this problem with the government overrunning them. Some of them are generally considered among the best-governed states in the country, Texas, Utah, Virginia. The other thing is that prior to McCain-Feingold, and even today, corporations are allowed to run certain issue ads. And these are the ads we've all seen that stop just short of saying vote for or vote against somebody. They'll get right up to the line. They'll say, boy, he's a scoundrel and a rogue, and he wants to, you know, destroy Social Security and your health care. So call him up and tell him we don't like that, you know. And that's allowed, at least in certain circumstances now. Prior to McCain-Feingold, which put limits on that, corporate soft money expenditures for that type of issue ad were still a fraction of the total spent on politics. And since McCain-Feingold, they've been an even smaller fraction, even though corporations can do it. Corporations provide less than 5% of the funding of these 527 organizations that we hear so much about that run exactly those type of issue ads. So empirically, there's not really a strong reason to think that's going to happen. And when I heard the quote from Senator McCain today, you know, I found myself thinking, I doubt that most Americans would even know the difference if, you know, just from observing campaigns, if this ban were lifted. It is true there would be, I think, a bit more speech and a bit different mix of speech, but I don't think your average viewer would even note the difference.
Okay. Again, Bradley Smith with the Federal Election, formerly with the Federal Election Commission. He was the chair of it. Rick Hassan, professor of law at Loyola Law School. Joan Biskupic with USA Today. We're going to continue this conversation after a brief break. On Reporter's Notebook, can the U.S. afford NASA's plans to go back to the moon and on to Mars? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Well, and I'll be back with To the Point, talking today about this extraordinary session of the U.S. Supreme Court 3 weeks before their official session is scheduled to begin to consider a campaign finance laws going back to Teddy Roosevelt in 1907. Also, of course, bringing up portions of the McCain Feingold Act, which is the most recent, the biggest most recent law to be passed in this area. Dave Leventhal is Communications Director for the Center for Responsive Politics. He also writes for and edits the group's Capital I blog. Dave Leventhal, welcome to you.
Pleasure to be here.
What do you think is important about this case?
When we look back to, say, 1992, and you look at soft money, which is a different animal than we're talking about here, but still instructive, there was about $88 million spent in soft money for that presidential cycle. By 2000, that was up to nearly a half a billion dollars worth of soft money being spent, about two-thirds of which was being spent by organizations and corporations. So what it says is that there is definitely an appetite out there for corporations to spend as much money as they possibly can when it comes to the political process. And it's going to be very curious, especially if this this decision that comes about is very broad, how quickly corporations would ramp up and how the political process would change. We expect that it would change very significantly.
What's wrong with that?
Well, we don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with it one way or another. But one thing that we are concerned about is the disclosure aspects about what's going on here. If you have an earth-shaking, earth-changing law that comes into place, and there aren't robust disclosure provisions in it, then we do worry very much and are very concerned about the ability for the public to actually find out who is financing political campaigns, who's making independent expenditures, and where the money is going and where the money is coming from. When you have a process, and not saying that this is going to happen, but it could, when you have a process that is very closed doors, where the corridors of politics become dark, that's when corruption is bred. That's when you have the types of troubles that have happened in the past when you haven't had laws on the books that make sure that the people of the United States of America know where the money is coming and where the money is going.
You've said this is earth-changing. You've said, as did the Senators McCain and Feingold, that corporate money is going to flood the political landscape. But we just heard from Bradley Smith that hasn't happened since McCain and Feingold. You have these statistics. What's the difference? How do you respond to what he said?
Well, McCain-Feingold basically outlawed soft money. So there has been several years where the game has changed quite a bit, and that leads up until today. What we're looking at the Supreme Court level right now is something that could change the rules all over again, and could possibly potentially lead to a great influx of money. Just looking at the soft money statistics, it is indicative of definitely an appetite for corporations to spend a lot of money if they have the ability to do so.
Rick Hassan, back to you, professor of law at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. What about this question of disclosure? Would that, if the court chose to insert something about it in a decision, help to mitigate whatever problems you might see as a result of increased corporate spending?
Well, there is actually, it was not featured in today's oral argument, there is a disclosure issue also in this case. But the Supreme Court, although it's divided pretty much 5-4 on the constitutionality of these corporate spending limits, it's pretty much 8-1 on disclosure laws and saying that they are generally constitutional. So I don't have a lot of concern that the disclosure laws are going to be in danger. My concern is more about this kind of unequal playing field. And to respond to Brad Smith's argument before about looking at the states, I don't think that we can make a direct comparison between what happens on the state level and, say, what happens on the presidential level. Who becomes president is a very important issue for many corporations and unions as well as for individuals. And, you know, the amount of spending on the presidential election and the last election, just looking at the candidates, was, you know, well over $1 billion. And so, you know, the scale of what it takes, and also for electing members of Congress, for electing senators, the scale of what it takes to elect members, what these campaigns look like, really dwarfs what goes on in most states, and the kinds of national issues that are involved are very different. So I don't think we can really draw lessons, nor can we draw lessons from these 527 organizations. There's been a lot of uncertainty about the law in terms of whether or not you can give to these organizations. Once the Supreme Court gives the green light, then I expect we're going to see massive amounts of corporate and union spending flowing into the federal election process.
Bradley Smith, back to you, former chair, Federal Election Commission. How do you respond to that?
Well, you know, I mean, to the extent we're asked to take some kind of restrictions on speech as an article of faith rather than evidence, I'm not overly persuaded. It's just not true. I mean, look, at the peak of soft money, it was a fraction of the total political spending in the United States. The amount given to 527s, which is 527s are a fraction of total political spending, and the amount given to them by corporations in recent years is about 2% of their total. So there can be room for a big increase, and it's not going to be some kind of, you know, thing where nobody can get their message out. I do expect you'll see more corporate speech, and I think that would be a good thing. That's part of the reason for wanting the ruling. People should have the opportunity to hear those messages and to learn stuff that's relevant to them. But the idea that we're just going to be drowned out is just, again, there's no real reason to believe that. State governments are very important. It's much easier to take over a state government, but the corporations don't do that. Most of them, they don't want to offend their shareholders. They don't have extra money laying around right now for politics. It's... You know, again, I think what we've got here is the effort to build up, frankly, a kind of a scare tactic, whereas you know, the reality is, again, the government is claiming broad authority to regulate political speech and stepping out and doing that on a daily basis. So I think we need to put the burden of proof on those who would limit speech, not on those who would argue for more.
David Leventhal, back to you with the Center for Responsive Politics. Where do you come down on this? Do you think that there ought to be unlimited free speech? Do you think that it's reasonable and constitutional to say that corporations, even though they are individuals under the law, can't have the same rights as everybody else?
On the actual outcome, we're neutral as an organization,
okay,
just based on what we do. But that being said, we find it very important that people know exactly what the history involved is here. And you look at, for example, lobbying expenditures that corporations and special interest organizations have just made in the healthcare debate, which, of course, is the hottest topic going right now here in Washington. And there's been $263 million worth of lobbying expenditures just by the health sector alone, and that's a considerable amount of money. And I think as it applies to what we're talking about here today, it's that organizations and corporations are definitely interested in influencing the political process. If they're allowed to influence the political process in a new way and directly out of their corporate treasuries or out of their union treasuries, to suggest that they wouldn't do so seems Pollyannish. Of course they will, and they will do so in spades. If you just take a fraction of a percent from the largest of companies, then you're looking at tens, even hundreds of millions of dollars. And of course, the point was made today, and we were at the Supreme Court, that, well, most corporations are little mom and pop outfits. They're small operations. They're the hairdresser. They're the car fixer. But you know, we're not talking about them necessarily. We're talking about the ExxonMobils. We're talking about the Blue Cross Blue Shields, the companies that truly do have a great deal of money and ostensibly would have a great deal of influence if they have the chance.
So, Professor Rick Hassan, would you look for a decision by the court that would make a distinction between different kinds and different degrees of funding, I guess you could say, for different corporations?
I don't think that that's very likely, although it is possible, as Brad Smith suggested, that the court could leave open the door for new regulations that would be targeted at larger corporations. I think that's a possibility. There are really, I'd say, a half a dozen ways that the case could be decided in favor of Citizens United. Really, the question now is not whether or not the government loses, but how it loses. It could lose well from the perspective of keeping most of the law intact with a narrow ruling that, say, video on demand broadcasts don't apply to McCain-Feingold. They could expand the exemption for nonprofit groups, which I think might be a sensible thing to do because this is really an ideological group and not ExxonMobil that's involved here. Or they could go broadly. And I think the fact that they ordered this second oral argument means that Roberts and Alito, who are the swing justices here, are thinking about going broadly.
Video on demand was the issue raised by the Hillary, the movie issue. Is that correct?
That's right. So this was not a normal television broadcast. You actually went, if you were a cable subscriber, you'd be able to go and request to see this. It would be downloaded to your DVR. And so the question, as a matter of statutory interpretation, is whether that's a kind of satellite or broadcast or cable communication that's covered by McCain-Feingold. That would be an easy technical way out where the court wouldn't have to address these issues. They could have done that back in June. The fact that they didn't means they're thinking bigger, at least some of them are.
Bradley Smith, would you agree with that, given the fact that the court did what it did and called this special hearing for today?
I think that's right. I think that's a big sign. And one thing I do want to point out is that while we've made a number of comments that the law is 100 years old and so on, it should be noted that the constitutionality of these laws was never really tested until 1990. I mean, that's why they're talking about overruling just a 1990 precedent, primarily because the laws had all kinds of ways in which they were readily avoided, easily gotten around. And it's as the laws for speech have gotten tougher and tougher, people keep turning to new ways to speak, and eventually it starts to cut awfully close to home, and so they finally have to challenge this kind of corporate ban. But it's a bit of an exaggeration to keep emphasizing a 100-year history behind these laws as if that's something the court would be overturning. It would be overturning a 1990 case that in many ways stands out as the odd man out in the court's campaign finance jurisprudence over the years.
It always sounds good to us, a journalist, to be able to talk in broad historical terms. What about the level playing field argument, though, that you've got AIG, you've got Exxon or whoever it is, or somebody who wants to influence the healthcare debate, and they can do that to a much greater extent than people that there or anybody that doesn't have that kind of law. Isn't there something fundamentally unfair about that?
Well, you know,
kind of resources. Excuse me.
I mean, as was pointed out, you know, the large corporations like that really gain their influence from lobbying, and they spend considerably more money on lobbying than they do on campaign spending. And so in certain ways, I think lifting the ban on campaign spending would actually have a sort of democratizing effect. That is, small and medium-sized corporations that can't afford full-time lobbying outfits would actually be able to sort of have a little more political influence vis-a-vis their much larger rivals. So I think that is not an argument that obviously, you know, cuts in favor of the big companies. And in fact, we see in this case the Committee for Economic Development, which consists entirely of very large Fortune 500 companies, is against overruling Austin, whereas the Chamber of Commerce, which has a lot of large members but also has over 96% of its members are very small businesses, is in favor of overruling Austin. And I think that reflects the dichotomy. Big business is not that keen to spend more on campaigns.
Dave Leventhal with the Center for Responsive Politics. Does that make sense?
It's possible. Anything is possible in this debate going forward. But again, we just go back to the history that we've seen of corporations spending money. The numbers speak for themselves, and corporations have shown a willingness to do this. Not all the time. Not all corporations. Not all companies. But some, definitely. They definitely do have a different tack to all of this than an individual would, because they do have to represent and have a fiduciary duty to their shareholders. And some may not want to go into these waters, but others will, and others will buy ads if they can buy ads and do independent advocacy to a significant level and some even beyond that.
Professor Hassan at Loyola Law School, elaborate, if you will, on the concern about corporations with the foreign money and foreign subsidiaries and what this might mean for them.
Yeah, well, that was one of the first sets of questions that Ted Olson faced today. Came from Justice Ginsburg asking about foreign money. And the answer that Olson gave was that there's still a First Amendment right to do this, but that in the case of foreign corporations or foreign-controlled corporations, the government might be able to demonstrate a compelling interest in limiting that money. But that would be a separate question that was not presented in the case, to which Justice Alito responded by saying, do you think that foreign-owned media corporations, and you could think here of Fox and Rupert Murdoch, have any less of a First Amendment right than a corporation owned by U.S. citizens? And so I think even on this question of foreign influence, the court is not necessarily going to agree that campaign spending by foreign corporations could be limited.
Bradley Smith, anything to add with regard to that issue?
No, I think that sums it up pretty well. There's a lot here, and again, in some ways this is an awkward case to get to the court, but I think the court has decided it's time to deal with it. In a brief that we filed, not with the Center for Competitive Politics, but with the former commissioners, we noted that the FEC, the Federal Election Commission, now has different regulations for 71 different types of speakers and for over 30 different types of speech. And so I think the court is to some extent saying, and I think Alito would be receptive to the idea that we need to quit trying to make these fine distinctions. The First Amendment says Congress will make no law, and we should have a broad position on it.
Dave Leventhal, let me ask you an interesting question raised by Eliot Spitzer, the former governor of New York, writing, I believe, in Slate magazine. He said that he's in favor, along with the ACLU and the National Rifle Association, of eliminating the limitations on corporate speaking. And he says, what about Bill O'Reilly on Fox News? What about Rachel Maddow on MSNBC? Aren't these people being paid by big corporations, bombarding the airwaves and trying very hard to change the political picture? What's the difference between that and the kind of political campaigning that we're talking about that's now so limited?
It's a fascinating point, and one that really strikes, it seems, to the heart of this case, which are the case, of course, being very different than a lot of the issues that we're talking about. These issues have sprung from that, which is the Hillary movie. And the core argument that's being made on behalf of the Hillary movie is that despite the fact that there are current limitations right now on when you can air different types of speech on air and how it's funded, that should just simply go away, because we should have the ability to do that. We should have the ability to consume that type of content, just as we today have the ability to consume a talker program like that is being funded, and the person's receiving a paycheck from a very moneyed corporation. So to say, well, which way is it going to go? It's unclear right now, but it is definitely a fascinating point.
Professor Hassan at Loyola Law School, when do you think the court is going to come up with a decision in this case?
Well, you know, there's no time limit here. This is a carryover from the last term. We do have one precedent, which is the McConnell case. The first case construing the McCain-Feingold law was argued in early September. The opinion issued in early December. But that case was much more complex than this, just in terms of the number of issues that were raised, including the question of Austin's vitality was raised there, too. So, you know, could be December. I would expect that the court is aiming to get something out before the 2010 election season gets going in earnest, because the court seems to be sensitive to not changing the electoral rules in the middle of an election. It could be November, could be October, could be later.
As to the makeup of the court, I would take it that Justice Sonia Sotomayor doesn't make a difference, given the fact that she seems to be in the minority. Justice Souter probably would have been as well.
Yeah, well, you know, the court has broken down 5-4 on these issues along the traditional liberal conservative lines. It's been Alito and Roberts who've been holding back from more extreme rulings in terms of overturning campaign finance laws. Sotomayor's questions today were directed at Citizens United, at Ted Olson, and they seem to suggest, why not decide this case on narrow grounds and not reach the constitutional question, which I think is exactly the position that Justice Souter would have taken if he remained on the court.
And Bradley Smith, you wouldn't call this an extreme ruling if they threw out the laws altogether.
No, I mean, it would be an important ruling, but I don't think it's an extreme ruling by any means, and I don't think it's some outrageous form of judicial activism. I would view it as more as correcting a decision that has long stood out as kind of the oddball case in campaign finance.
And Dave Leventhal, you would think that other kinds of corrections might be needed if the court ruled broadly.
It seems that regardless of which way this goes, that this is probably far from the last chapter on it. It seems that campaign finance law is constantly morphing, and every few years you get something that's coming up yet again. And we've seen it in 2003, we saw it in 1990, and we've seen plenty of cases before that, so there's no reason to think that this will be the end of it.
Dave Leventhal with the Center for Responsive Politics and Capital I Blog. Bradley Smith, the former chair of the Federal Election Commission, now professor at Capital University in Ohio and chair of the Center for Competitive Politics. Rick Hassan, professor of law at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. Thanks to you all and to Joan Biskupic of USA Today, our earlier guest. NASA has big plans to send humans back to the moon and to Mars, but it lacks the money to meet its goals. That's the conclusion of a Blue Ribbon Committee formed to advise President Obama. We'll look at his available options in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. President Obama appointed former Lockheed Martin chair Norman Augustine to head a review of America's space program. His Human Space Flight Plans Committee has now released its executive summary, which concludes that NASA is on an unsustainable trajectory. Jonathan McDowell is an astronomer at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. Welcome back to our program.
Hi, Warren. It's good to be back.
Tell us what that means, an unsustainable trajectory, and are you surprised by that conclusion?
Not at all. I think that many of us said when the previous administration laid out its plan to go back to the moon that the budget wasn't realistic. It was a great idea, astronauts back to the moon, but Congress didn't even fund it at the level that the administration asked for, and even that level wouldn't have been enough to make it happen on a reasonable timescale. And what's great about this new commission report is I think it's the first really honest assessment of how much it'll take to do various ambitious things in space that we've seen in a long time.
Now, first honest assessment of what? Not just going to the moon, but also going to Mars? What about lesser kinds of exploration?
Right. I think there's some exciting options there, and the commission has it's laid out 8 different options that it's numbered, 1 through 5C, because that's what commissions do, and they range from ones which they're obviously saying to President Obama, yeah, you really don't want to do this one. And there's some others where they're kind of hinting, yeah, we kind of like this way to go. So they're saying that if you don't increase the budget, then human spaceflight is going to be very boring. We're going to have to kill off the space station that we just spent $100 billion building. We're not going to be able to get to the moon for many, many years. And really nothing much is going to happen that will excite the American public. For a relatively small increase in the budget, maybe a 15% increase in NASA's budget, a few extra billion, and then keeping up with inflation, you can do either go back to the moon or do what they call the flexible path. And this is very clearly what the commission is trying to push the administration into doing. The flexible path would send astronauts to different places in the solar system. We would fly around the moon. We would fly to asteroids going around the sun. And eventually we might fly to visit the moons of Mars. But staying out for the time being of the deep gravity holes, the surface of the moon and the surface of Mars, which are just too expensive to get to in the near term.
A lot of people argue that human spaceflight is really not worth what it costs, that what we ought to do is send robots to do all of these things. Why would you want to fly around the moon or visit the asteroids or the moons of Mars?
The idea is to develop the capability to get humans out into space and the longer-term goal of colonizing other planets. You're absolutely right that to do scientific research, to understand the origin of the planets and stuff like that, robots are better. Robots are cheaper. You can do more with them more quickly. But if you believe, as many in the spaceflight community believe, that we want to go and we want to actually colonize other worlds, ultimately, you've got to send people. It's not the same thing being there as sending a robot. So the question is, how do you get to that point realistically?
What about private enterprise? The commission, or the committee rather, had something to say about that.
Absolutely. We're retiring the shuttle now, and NASA has already made huge steps in getting going with commercial replacements for getting astronauts to the station. It was a little slow getting off the ground, so there's going to be a gap before they're ready, but there will be spaceships built by private companies and operated by private companies that take astronauts to the space station and back.
What are they going to do there?
The people on the space station are going to do research. They're going to study medicines in zero gravity. There was a recent discovery of a drug that can help with Salmonella poisoning, I believe, and things like that, a clue that they found by studying it in zero gravity helped them develop a new therapy. So that's the sort of thing they want to do on the space station, as well as developing expertise that will eventually lead them to how you operate for a long time in space, and you need to be able to survive for a long time in space if you want to go to Mars in the end.
What about cooperating with other countries in order to raise the kind of money you need to develop the ability to fly with the objective of colonizing other bodies?
Yeah, that's kind of the big gap in this report, because it's really about what the U.S. wants to do. And the history of this is that the U.S. makes a decision and then it says to other countries, this is what we're going to do. You want to come along?
Hmm.
The current plan in the budget, no one really thinks it's going to happen, I think, but the current plan in the budget is to kill off the space station in just a few years. If we do that, not only will it be a waste of investment, but it'll mean that all the other countries who spent billions buying into the space station will never trust us again. And so I think, if we want to, as you say, get the investment of other countries, if you like, a coalition of the willing to get to Mars, then you've got to keep the space station going for a while, too, just to establish our credibility.
Based on his campaign statements and what he said so far, what do you think President Obama will do?
It's a hard call because it's not like we have a large amount of money. On the other hand, it really is just restoring NASA's budget, inflation adjusted, to closer what it used to be in the 90s. And it's, NASA's budget is still only about half what it was in the Apollo years, adjusted for inflation. I think he will find a way to give NASA a little more money. And there's a good chance, I think, that he will go for this flexible path option, which does have the benefits of having some moderately spectacular flights within the careers of people now living, as opposed to really spectacular stuff that won't happen for decades.
Dr. Jonathan McDowell at the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, also of Jonathan's Space Report. Thanks so much for being with us.
Always good to talk with you, Warren.
Today's program produced by Gary Scott with Sonia Geis and Andrea Brody. Our technical director is Wesley Roberts. Managing producer Karen Radziner. You can email us or share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/to the point. I'm Marvin Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.